Now I'm going to talk about something that probably you're all too young to remember. But back in the 50s, the 1950s that is, there was a young man who burst onto the music scene unlike any ever before him. His name was Aaron Presley. All right, his first name was Elvis. But Elvis Presley. And this was a tall, athletic, good-looking guy with a great set of lungs. And when he started singing a new style of music, this recently birthed rock and roll, it just captivated people. And because he was so energetic and charismatic, his music sold like hotcakes, and his followers were unlike any other before. The women would swoon watching him perform. You've heard the saying, women wanted him and men wanted to be like him. This was how people felt about Elvis Presley. And when he got up on stage, he had a way of shaking his hips. So he had another nickname, Elvis the Pelvis. But he was better known as the King. The people who loved and adored him, they worshiped him. They worshiped Elvis the King. That was their response to this outburst of energy and vigor and music and rhythm. But there were others who responded in a slightly different manner. Because you see, what Elvis ushered in was this enormous wave of music popularity. He was generating an awful amount of wealth, and people wanted to grab a hold of that. And so if there was an opportunity to be a partner with him in some way, shape, or form, these people weren't so interested so much in worshiping Elvis as they were on capitalizing on what he had done. So if you could partner with him, great. If you could find the next Elvis, fantastic. But it was all tied into what he was doing, and people just wanted to grab a hold of it. But there was a third group of people in how they responded to this onset of Elvis. These were people who did not like rock and roll music at all. They thought that he was detracting from their appreciation of what music was. Music was supposed to be this, and he's doing that. They were offended by his gyrations on the stage. They thought it was obscene. They sought to censor his shows on TV. In fact, there were a while where the cameras would only be waist up on Elvis. And so you had this group of people who didn't think that he was the King. In fact, they thought he was Satan incarnate. They didn't want to worship him. They wanted to see him obliterated from the scene and wiped out. Three different responses to the rise of the one known as the King. There have been similar responses to similar charismatic figures over the years. But we're here because we worship Jesus. And so I want to use that sort of phrasing, if you will, to bring us back into our journey through the Gospel of John. Because we find ourselves now, as Anne read, in John chapter 12. And it gives us an opportunity to look at how people responded to the goodness of the one true King. I'm going to set the stage for you because, as always, context is important. We see, starting out with verse 1, that we are now 6 days before the Passover. This is really important to understand. John's not yet halfway through the chapters of his gospel, but we're now on the last week of the life of Jesus. In less than 1 week's time, he will be in a tomb. John finds that much importance in what happens from this point forward, that that's what he focuses on. Passover is approaching, and they are in Bethany. For the last several weeks, Jesus has known that there was essentially a price on his head. And so he and his apostles and his closest disciples have been just on the edge of the Judean wilderness, spending some concentrated time as Jesus poured into them, knowing that there wasn't much time left. But now it is time. And so he's made his way back to Bethany. And the thing to know about Bethany, and I've mentioned this before, is Bethany is 2 miles from Jerusalem. That means it's 2 miles from the temple. It also means it's 2 miles from Golgotha, where he will be crucified. He's close. He's very close. The timing of this event, 6 days before the Passover, it appears that this is taking place on a Saturday, the Sabbath. And a meal has been prepared. Jesus is the guest of honor, but Lazarus is also one of the featured guests too. That makes sense. You bring a guy back to life in a small hometown, he's going to be a big to-do. And so if you're going to honor Jesus, what better way than to have next to him the guy he brought back from life? Back from death. Now, what the crowd didn't understand is that Lazarus' resurrection was just the warm-up act for what would take place in a little over a week. But there is this party being held. Interesting thing, I've often preached the importance of context. We need to understand that John's gospel is not a standalone book. There's more information in the other books of the Bible. And so if you were to read in Matthew's gospel or Mark's gospel, particularly Matthew 26 and Mark 14, what you would find is it tells of a banquet in Bethany around the last week of the life of Jesus. People have speculated, is it the same? I'm of the mindset that it absolutely is. And so we can pull some details out of that and learn that even though Mary and Martha and Lazarus are present at this feast, it's not at their house. It's being hosted by Simon the leper. And the reason for that could be really simple. It could be that he just has a better house for hosting what would be truly a big banquet. So it is at the house of Simon the leper. It's in Bethany. And we see that Martha's doing what Martha does. Martha is serving. That's how she loves. We saw it back in a similar banquet, a similar meal captured in Luke chapter 10, where Martha is once again doing all the serving and Mary is at Jesus' feet. And Martha says, Lord, would you tell her to help me? Because she was feeling a little overwhelmed. And Jesus said, Martha, Martha, you're focused on the wrong things. Appreciate the fact that you're serving, but this is a better choice right now. Martha can't help herself. She has a servant's heart. And so she is serving as we get into this. Lazarus is doing what Lazarus does. He's reclining at the table. And so this wonderful feast is taking place. But presumably towards the end of the feast, Mary does something remarkable. Patty was saying that this ought to be taught and thought of as an ordinary act of worship. But the reality is what she does here is so extraordinary that here we are talking about it 2,000 years later. Depending upon the translation that you have, she takes what's either a pound or a pint of pure nard. This is an incredibly valuable perfume. And you ladies know that you apply perfume a little dab, a little spritz. You don't take something of this size and dump it. But that's precisely what Mary does. She takes the whole container and in an act of extravagant worship, she pours it on Jesus. Now, in the versions that are captured in Mark and Matthew's Gospels, what we are told is that she pours it on his head. John's Gospel here says that Mary wipes it off of his feet, but there's no inconsistency there because this is a lot of perfume. And if you dump this on my head, it's going to run all the way down. And so Mary anoints Jesus with this truly extravagant gift, a sacrificial offering. It is her first fruits that she is offering to Jesus. But then she does something that I think would have taken all of us aback. If we'd been there and seen her do that, we would have been taking notice. But then she drops down before him, prostrates herself before him, and uses her hair to wipe the excess off of her feet. I don't know if you can put yourself in the crowd at that time to imagine what was going on. The smell of perfume is now everywhere. If you were within any distance of it, you now have benefited from that smell. It's soaking into Jesus' clothes. It's soaking into every porous surface in the room. It's the volume that she's released. And to see her willing to do that and then to humble herself completely before him must have just been almost a nerve-wracking experience to see somebody who could worship that wholly and completely. I promise you, she wasn't interested in what anybody else was thinking. She was focused solely on the object of her adoration and worship. She saw none other than Christ alone. But let it be noted that there were others in the room. Clearly, this was a banquet. There were other people watching, observing this act of extravagance. Now, Matthew and Mark, when they write about what happens next, what they say is that the disciples objected to what took place. And I want to speak to that for a moment because John names names. He doesn't just let you go with a general. He gets specific. He says Judas is the one who objects. And this becomes significant here because if all you did was read the other accounts, you might have an opinion of Judas that several have put forth over the years that Judas really wasn't that bad of a guy. And that ultimately when he turned over Jesus, what he was trying to do was force Jesus' hand to get him to rise up as the king and exude the authority that he has over heaven and earth to slay the oppressive powers. That's been something that people have said about Judas, but context doesn't allow us that because when we read John's gospel, we get more details about Judas. Judas raises a very good objection, though, and I think we need to take note of what Judas says, because what he says is, why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii, or days or year's wages, and given to the poor? That's a perfectly reasonable thing to say. Why this sudden, complete, and total act of indulgence, if you will, this act of worship that is only going to be of momentary benefit when we could have sold that perfume and used it to feed the poor? An interesting struggle between how we allocate resources. I'll get to that a little bit further on, but to anybody that was hearing this objection, it had to strike a tone of reason to it. Money gone like that for this guy? When we see real needs, how do we do that? Something to keep in mind there. It's really easy to raise objections to how other people choose to use their money as opposed to how you choose to use your own. Just throwing that out there. Anyway, now the truth of Judas's character is revealed. He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Judas makes a reasonable objection, but the objection has absolutely nothing to do with a heart for the poor. It has everything to do with a heart for himself. Judas has found a way to hang out with Jesus to benefit Judas. Not out of a desire to worship Jesus, but out of a desire to increase his station in life, to improve his material standing, to get a better life. He's not bowing before the throne. He's standing behind it looking for ways to siphon off the gold. That is the heart of Judas that gets revealed here. And we need to keep that in mind as well. So then we have this interesting little diversion from the points that I'm trying to make, but they are points that we need to take a look at anyway. Because Jesus responds to Judas's objection. And you imagine he's not just speaking to Judas when he says this, he's speaking to everybody. He says, leave her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. Jesus is letting folks know, my time is almost done. I've told you before that we're heading up here where I'm going to die. I'm reinforcing it right now. And what she just did is in keeping with what a lot of people do with the dead. You would find that their approach to taking a dead body is to wrap it in spices and oils, because decomposition is not a pleasant thing. So if you can preserve the best memories of somebody that way. And what Jesus is saying, what she is doing is preparing my body for what's about to come. This was an act of sacrifice, but an act of preparation. She desired to worship me, but she has been a part of God's plan of my execution and my burial. But then he says something that should get us all thinking. The poor you will always have with me. Now, I put to you that this is not Jesus' way of saying anything other than we continue to need to be serving and helping the poor. But what Jesus is doing here is he is reestablishing an order that he established when he was asked, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus' response was, the first and greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And then the second is to love your neighbor as yourself. And when we care for the poor, when we give not just out of our abundance, but out of our scarcity to help those who have less, we are loving them as we love ourselves. But our first obligation is to love God. And so what Mary has done is to worship God first. That's never the wrong thing to do. Jesus is rectifying her thoughts on that. But we see that there's a third group of people in these readings that we need to be mindful of. Because it turns out the folks in Jerusalem are really up in arms about what's taking place here. They have already put out a warrant for Jesus' death. And now Lazarus, because Lazarus stands as a testament to Jesus' authority over life and death, they want to kill him too. The more they see Jesus do, the more their anger rises. It boils down to two things. Every person that goes to follow Jesus isn't following them anymore. And they'd already put out an edict. If you worship Jesus, you're out of the synagogue. The reality is you kick people out of the synagogue, it hurts your power base. It diminishes your authority. And so Jesus is robbing them of what they think they are worthy of doing. They are worthy of being worshipped. They are worthy of being held in high esteem. And Jesus is taking that away from them. But the second problem, getting beyond their ego, is the realization that the Roman governing system has recognized the Jews as sort of the ones that keep peace in Israel. And if more people are going to Jesus, they're getting away from their ability to influence peace, and they're worried about an insurrection. They're worried about the boot of the Roman army coming crashing down on their throats. And so they feel like Jesus is taking something that is not rightly his, it's theirs. And they're enraged by it. They think the one who's called the King of Kings is Satan himself. Three groups, three responses when confronted with the goodness of God. One who wants to pour out everything that she has, to give extravagantly, lavishly, to leave nothing behind. One group that wants to figure out how they can live their best life today based upon the rising tide that Jesus has created. I don't want to worship him, but I want to enjoy what he's got going on around him. We'll let others make the sacrifices while we reap the benefits. And then there's this third group. I want to touch on that third group again for just a quick moment. Because the people who wanted to kill Jesus were religious. They would tell you that they were trying to worship God. But somehow along the way, they allowed their fears and concerns about who the Messiah would be. And by the way, they knew that there was a Messiah called for in the scriptures. And they even knew that the timing was right. But when they saw what Jesus was doing, instead of worrying about worshiping the one true God, they started worrying about their comfort and their power. As a result, the God that they worshiped shifted. It shifted from being the creator God to the God they created. And that's never right. Any God who is not the triune God, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit, is a God of man's making. Some of those worldviews, and I'm going to call all of them worldviews with the exception of Christianity, all of those other worldviews will lead you to fight for their worldview. There are some that'll even tell you to kill for their worldview. Christ is the only one that says, lay down your life for my worldview. To live is Christ, to die is gain. The worldview that Jesus brings in is that this world will perish, but my kingdom will last forever. So seek first that kingdom and my righteousness, and everything will be added unto you. The worship that we are called to have when faced with the goodness of God is all in. It's giving him everything we got. It's pouring a year's worth of wages out lavishly to honor him. It's denying yourself and following wherever he calls you to go to worship him. It's taking up your own cross to worship him. Of the ways that you can respond in the presence of the goodness of the King, there's only one that will lead you into the kingdom. I encourage you all to consider the lavishness of the gift that Mary gave that day, the fact that we're talking about it today, 2,000 years later, and ask yourself, what have I been willing to give for the King of Kings and Lord of Lords? Have I, with my life, demonstrated a worship as extravagant as what she did? I would tell you, there's no other way to worship the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords than to do just that. Think about that this week, would you? And that's enough today. Amen.